Well, it is my privilege to introduce to you at this time our special guest and speaker for the evening, Dr. Oz Guinness. Dr. Guinness was born in China, educated in England, has written probably more than 25 books. Writing is sort of a way of life for Oz these days. Written a lot of books, among them a book called The Call, The Long Journey Home. Some of you have that one. Unspeakable. Most recently, The Case for Civility. Dr. Guinness is a frequent speaker at seminars and speaks to political and business conferences, both in the United States as well as in Europe and Asia. He has lectured at many of the world's leading universities, has spoken frequently to government leaders. We advertised the topic for him tonight, civility in the emerging global public square. He may touch on that, but you know, speakers can do it. They can say whatever they want to say once they get up here, right? This happens to be also, you know, the week of the celebration, or next week, the celebration of the 10th anniversary of the signing of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, a topic which Dr. Guinness has a lot to say about as well. So whatever he chooses to speak about tonight, let's welcome Dr. Oz Guinness.
Thank you, John. Thank you all. It's a tremendous pleasure to be back at this dinner. I thoroughly enjoyed my visit a few years back, and I'm glad to be back. Particularly on the eve of this historic anniversary for the United Nations. You know, of course, that it happened not here in New York, but in Paris on December the 10th, 1948. Although there was another great day here in New York, not far from here, the American Bill of Rights, which is one of the predecessors of the Universal Declaration, which happened on December the 15th, 1791, not far from here. So it's an enormous privilege for me. My family is actually Irish, and I was born in China, as John said, and lived in three continents. But I did go to school in England, so I have a little bit of an English accent left. So Americans often ask me why on earth I address things American as an Englishman, when of course the revolution was against the English. I often just joke in reply by telling the story of Winston Churchill. When he was prime minister, he was taken down to Williamsburg. And the guide was showing him round the capital of the revolution against the English, as she put it politely. And then she stopped halfway through the sentence and said, "Mr. Prime Minister, forgive me, I don't mean to be insulting you." "Insulting me," he said. "It was a revolution of Englishmen with English ideas against a German king with his German mercenaries. And I know what it is to fight that struggle." The Declaration, of course, takes its place in a long line of great declarations. It is the most important statement on human rights in history. The great Greek historian Thucydides said that history is the arena of the struggle between conscience and power. Between reason and conscience on one side, and power and interest on another side. And the Universal Declaration was a ringing cry on behalf of reason and conscience. It was a beacon which expresses brilliantly the aspirations of humanity. It was a benchmark by which humans can assess their achievements towards those goals. And it was a blueprint which has empowered many to codify what it said into their laws. 26 nations have references to it in their laws. And clearly it was the launch pad of the modern human rights movement. And groups like Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and many others quote it and rely on it in much that they do. But we don't want today a hollow celebration. Because as we look back over 60 years, there are tremendous challenges and lessons for our time. And our challenge is to pick up that torch and to carry it on with the particular challenges that we face today at the beginning of the 21st century. So what I want to do tonight is tell you four stories, and in each case just tie in some simple lessons and challenges from each of the four stories. The first story is an American story. In 1843, a young scholar was doing research on the last surviving veterans of the Revolutionary War. And he met an old 91-year-old who had fought at both Lexington and Concord. And he said to him, beginning the interview, "What did you go out to fight for?" And the old gentleman was very bowed, and he stretched himself up to his full height and looked down disapprovingly. Why on earth was anyone asking a question that was so obvious? The student was a little flustered, and he said, "Well, didn't you go out to fight oppression?" "We weren't oppressed," he said. "Well, what about the Stamp Act?" "Never saw a single stamp," he said. "What about the tea tax?" "Never drank a drop of it," he said. "The boys threw it in the harbor in Boston before we got any of it." By this stage, the student was getting a little rattled, and he said, "Well, surely you've been reading books like John Locke and the Great Ideas of Freedom?" "Never heard of them," the old boy said. "All we had was a Bible and an almanac and a hymn book." By that stage, the student didn't know what to say, and he said, "Well, why then did you go out to fight?" The old boy said, "We had always been free, and we intended to be free always, and the red coats were in our way." Now, there's a lesson there. Freedom and justice are always more than declarations. Many people look back at Magna Carta, the English Bill of Rights, the Virginia Declaration, the Declaration of Independence, the French Declaration of Rights, all the various rights declarations right down to the UN Universal Declaration. But actually, freedom and justice don't just live there. And if you examine what that old boy was saying, along with the declarations of thinkers, freedom and justice live in the hearts of people through symbols. Just those of us who visited this country take what things like the Liberty Tree or Yankee Doodle or today the flag means to Americans, or the Statue of Liberty so close to here. Symbols that cannot quite be put in words are just as powerful as the most ringing declarations. But deeper even than that, what you can see in the old gentleman's words is what Alexis de Tocqueville, the Frenchman, called habits of the heart. Things that are second nature, things that are instinctual, things that come almost unspoken from our mother's milk. And when freedom and justice live certainly in declarations, but also in symbols, but supremely in the habits of the heart, then freedom and justice will be strong, not just on parchment. Put differently, freedom and justice depend on three things, not just one. Declarations are a matter of moral suasion. And the Universal Declaration is a ringing example of that. All human beings are born free and equal, and so on. A ringing declaration, which is a powerful moral suasion. But as you know well from the beginning, the argument was, should they work for a declaration only, or should there be a legal covenant too? And for various reasons, partly it would take much longer, they went for the declaration alone. But of course, moral suasion needs a second element. Legal provisions. Much harder, takes much longer, but gives certain bedrock guarantees that the law is on behalf of justice and freedom. But then, of course, where do the habits of the heart come from? And the answer to that is what used to be called liberal education. In countries that are free, people are born free, but they're not necessarily born wise and equal to the challenges of freedom. And that's where, in families and in schools, there needs to be the civic education in what freedom and justice and respect and human rights mean in the small places and the grassroots level. We need to remind ourselves again that declarations will never be enough. There is more to freedom than declarations. Or a second story, this time a Polish story. In the 1930s, there was a young, shy legal scholar called Raphael Lemkin. And in his studies, he was passionately concerned with the mass slaughter of peoples, the killing of the Armenians in World War I, and then in 1933, the killing of the Assyrians in the Middle East. And he wrote a passionate essay called The Crime of Barbarity and dedicated his life to standing against those things. And within a few years, his own people, the Jews, were caught up in that in Hitler's Final Solution. Lemkin himself lost 49 members of his family to the Holocaust. But as the intensity of his search went on, trying to awaken the American president and the British prime minister to do something about it, he searched for a word that would blend both precision and yet a passion, so that just the one word alone, as he said, would be an index of civilization. And when you said this word, you would have both moral condemnation and a moral aspiration to justice. And today, when you look over his writing, some of the pages of his notebooks are almost indecipherable. But at one point, he's got the word circled. And then you can see a line to the other words, moral judgment. And of course, you know the word that he coined. A new word in the human lexicon, genocide. The mass murder of peoples. Now, the lesson here, I think, is although he was passionate about it and hoped that the very word itself would be a one-word stand against all that was so barbarous, we know now that that doesn't happen. And even when American presidents and many other world leaders say, we will never forget, we will never forget, those two words, never forget, ring out like a bell in the fog of the 20th century or like a litany. And yet, it's happened again and again and again. And the lesson here, I think, is this. There is more to a passion for justice than just outrage. Much of the Universal Declaration was written against the backdrop of the massive revulsion of what we'd seen in World War II. Supremely, the Nazi barbarism in the death camps and in the horrendous experiments by the Nazi doctors. And you can see in the second clause of the Universal Declaration a specific reference to what had horrified the conscience of mankind. Behind that, the evil of colonialism. And even the great powers who were part of the drafting process were themselves part of the colonial masters, and many of the evils, Britain, Belgium, France, were still doing. And the third conscious revulsion which lies behind the Declaration are the treatment of minorities, even in countries which are calling themselves civilized. Supremely, South Africa with apartheid. But not only that, embarrassingly for the Americans, here. And as the Soviet delegates liked to point out again and again as they talked about human rights, while they were doing this and the Americans were championing it, blacks were being lynched and hung from trees in the south of the United States. So there's no question that this cry for justice, this outrage and revulsion against injustice, is one of the great motivations which fuels the Universal Declaration. And yet by itself, it's never been enough. Because there were criticisms then, and those criticisms are here today. The first criticism, that the whole Universal Declaration is a statement of ethnocentrism. In 1947, the American Anthropological Association put in a huge memo to the commission saying they would refuse to sign it because it was Western values imposed on other people. All of us are children of our own culture. So there's no transcendent reference point outside any culture. So clearly, any statement put out to the rest of the world is inevitably ethnocentric. The second criticism then, and equally a criticism in parts of the world today, is a related one, that it was a matter of cultural imperialism. Some people imposing their views on other people. Most of the political rights traced back to the West, and most of the social and economic rights traced back to the Latin Americans. And then, of course, the third challenge then and the third challenge now is one I virtually mentioned earlier, hypocrisy. Many of those who are pushing these things were doing things which openly violated the rights that they were fighting for. And we've seen that since, sadly, in the 60 years. Leaders in the Human Rights Commission with the most appalling record of human rights in the world. And even champions of human rights, like the United States, accused today of things in Guantanamo Bay and so on, which have stained the reputation of this country. In other words, outrage alone will never be enough. A third story, this time an English story. There was wealthy young Englishman, actually born the same year as our Guinness Family Brewery, 1759. He was a friend of my great-great-grandfather's. Grew up, went to Cambridge, young man of privilege and carelessness. As he said, when he entered Parliament as a 21-year-old, his only interest was his own interest. He whored, he gambled, he lived a fast, leisured, privileged life until he was introduced to the tragedy of the evil of slavery. And he was challenged to be the one to pick up this issue. And he ducked it at first. But then, having come to faith and wrestled with his conscience for 2 years, he wrote down in his journal what's said to be the most audacious personal mission statement in history. God Almighty has set before me two great objects, the suppression of the slave trade and the reformation of manners. 47 years later, 3 days before he died, the abolition of slavery happened through the British Empire and slowly through much of the Western world. But there's a lesson in his story. There is more to victory over injustice than just idealism. When we look at the human rights problems of the world then and now, there are profound questions, even at the intellectual and ethical level. For example, what is the basis of human rights in a world as divergent as ours? The UN Declaration says it's because we're born free and therefore human dignity is ours. But why? For example, there are totalitarian countries, some of which I've lived in, where the individual is subservient to the state. What then are individual rights? I remember when I was a student in London University knowing Bertrand Russell, the great atheist philosopher, for whom humans are an accident in the universe, and the universe itself is moving towards disaster. What then is the value of an individual human, especially if they're broken or impaired or poorly educated or physically handicapped? Or we have professors down the road from here, from New York, in Princeton, Peter Singer, for example, who would say that thinking we're any different from animals is a matter of species conceit. We're only animals. We should give animals the rights we have, and we have no more rights than the animals around us. What then is human dignity? You can see in our world today that one of the easy challenges to human rights is, while we can make these ringing declarations, the actual basis of it is lacking in many individual and many government positions. A second challenge, of course, is the very notion of universality. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But why universal? As human beings, we all speak from somewhere. None of us speaks from nowhere. That's impossible. None of us speaks from everywhere. That's incoherent. We all speak from somewhere. How then do we claim what we see is truly universal? I mentioned the American Anthropological Association. They were quickly answered by a great UNESCO report from many intellectuals around the world who argued human rights could be universal. Because although the roots of the rights were very divergent, there was enough overlap among human beings to make these genuinely universal. But that, again, as you know, in many university discussions and others, is highly challengeable today. And no longer can we just assert the right without knowing why. And the third challenge today is one of inclusions. As it's put simply, who has a right to the rights? If you take the American discussion, for example, you can see in their political debate today that the homosexuals have demanded a right to the rights. But behind them, also asking the same thing, are polygamists. And behind them, pedophiles. Anyone who can claim to be part of the category. And on the other hand, you have laws in America so that children can actually be born and left to die, although they're living for an hour, 2 hours, or whatever, and if they only had medical care, they would last easily and be with us tonight. The UN Declaration talks about the birthright, born free, and there are people in this country who are born, but whose lives are not considered worth living, and they're left to die. And you have the ethical, profound questions of who really is included. Not easy. How about the practical level? If you study the life of William Wilberforce, it was far more than idealism that won abolition. First, there was teamwork. He and his friends were described as a meeting that never adjourned. Wherever they were talking about the things that mattered to them and they were pursuing. Wilberforce is described as a prime minister of a cabinet of philanthropists. And that didn't mean giving out money. It meant people who were passionately concerned with causes for good and justice around the world. And all of them together, in the age before the word networking, they were networkers. The second thing you can see from Wilberforce's life is the importance of persuasion. Before law is always culture, the winning of hearts and minds. And Wilberforce knew he had to win hearts and minds before he could abolish slavery in Parliament through law, and that's what he did. Many of the British people at the time thought slavery was a nasty business, but necessary, and of course economically valuable. And Wilberforce had to persuade them that the slaves were humans. The American Constitution made them 3/5 human. And among many things Wilberforce did, he had a little plate put out by his great friend Wedgwood of the China factory. And in the middle, the head of a slave in chains. And round the edge of the plate, a question mark, because a question mark, a question is always more subversive than a statement. And the question was simply this: am I not a man and a brother? And that little plate went out all over the stately homes of Britain and Europe, and the question lodged in people's minds. Just one tiny example of his campaign of persuasion. But the third thing was perseverance. For nearly 20 years, year after year after year, his bills thrown out, a failure. And his health was almost wrecked, and his fortune spent in all he put into it. But as I said, 3 days before he died, 47 years after he began, he won. And he was described, after being once the most vilified man in Europe, he was described at his death as the George Washington of humanity. It takes more than idealism. One last story, this time switching to Asia. There's a well-known story of an American Christian who went over to West Irian Jaya. And he was living among some of the tribes there, doing all sorts of things for them. He also shared his faith. But as he discovered to his horror, the value of the tribe he was in was treachery. And one of their greatest delights was to make someone think that he was trusted by the tribe and welcomed into a feast and then killed and eaten. So when this gentleman was sharing with the people the story of Jesus of Nazareth, and you know how Jesus was betrayed by his friend and follower Judas, the tribe got very excited every time he told the story. And then when they came to the kiss of betrayal and Judas betraying Jesus with the kiss, the whole tribe would burst into applause. Judas was the hero. Jesus was the sucker. Then he discovered that when he told the tribe, if they kept on warring against their neighbor tribes like this, he was going to leave them. No more medicine, no more of the things he was bringing them. And they needed his medicine. So they said, we'll make peace with our neighboring tribe. And one day he saw the two tribes and their warriors face to face. And to his amazement, the chief of his tribe took from his wife a newborn baby, leaving his wife sobbing in the background. Took the baby down each of his own warriors who laid their hands on the baby. And when everyone had done that, he took the baby and gave it to the chief of the other tribe. And every member of the other tribe laid hands on the baby and disappeared into the forest. And he asked them what this meant. And he said, they said to him, this is what we call a peace child. When the child of one tribe is given completely to the other, while that child lives, there can be peace. I think there's a deep lesson here. There is more to peace than dialogue. Interfaith dialogue is important, it is valuable, but it's limited. Because while we as humans have a deep human solidarity, there are also profound and irreducible differences between humans, which will always be there. In other words, when we talk of the Universal Declaration, we haven't reached a lowest common denominator unity that's below all the diversity of our humanness. No, no. We have a fragile unity that is an overlapping consensus in the roots of our beliefs were very, very different. But fortunately, in the results of our beliefs when it comes to rights, there is enough of an overlap to say something very important. Many of the world movements today are towards interfaith dialogue. They will be disappointing. They will only go so far. The differences, ideological and religious, in human experience are ultimate and irreducible. What we need instead is a framework of agreed rights and respect and responsibility within which we are free to be ourselves with our differences and responsible in being able to negotiate our differences. I happen to think we're at a very opportune moment for the world. Three things are coming together in our generation. First, we see the seriousness of the challenge of living with our deepest differences. Partly through migration, partly through the media, partly through travel, it's now said that everyone is now everywhere. And when we talk of living with our deep differences, we can see that ethnic and sectarian violence is one of the great tragedies and challenges of our world. And it isn't just that little private faiths are elbow to elbow with other little private faiths, but profound worldviews are elbow to elbow within the same society with other profound worldviews. Living with our deep differences has become one of the world's great challenges. At the same time, a second factor comes into play. We now recognize almost universally the significance of civil society. That societies are healthy when between the grassroots citizens and the government at the highest level, there are all sorts of organizations and nonprofits in which people can volunteer and engage and sacrifice and give and play their part in tackling the world's problems. And you can see today a robust growth in civil society around the world. Now that, of course, assumes living with our deepest differences. But a third factor is coming into play. In the age of the computer and the internet, we are seeing the emergence of a global public square. The Greeks were the first to say what a public square was, the agora, the place where citizens came to debate and deliberate and decide matters of common public concern. And in many countries since the Greeks, that has been a metaphor. So that in this country, the public square would include not only the Congress, the Senate, and the House, but also the op-ed pages of the newspaper, and everywhere where citizens come together to debate things of public concern. But suddenly, the internet's changed that. And we now have the emergence of a global public square. One of the features of our world is even when we're not speaking to the world, we can be heard by the world. The Pope was caught unawares, by surprise, with the reactions to his speech at Regensburg. You can think of the reactions to the cartoons in Denmark. Even when people are not speaking to the world today, they can be heard by the world, and the challenge is in the emerging global public square. How do we live with our deep differences so that diversity becomes a matter of strength and richness and not a matter of weakness and conflict? An extraordinary moment 60 years on. Let there be no empty celebration. And let there be a celebration with a full understanding of the challenges of human rights and human justice and human freedom in our world, especially as now that we're aware, the question is, how do we live with our deepest differences? The Christian Embassy is clear where it comes from. I too am a follower of Jesus of Nazareth. Many of you come from different backgrounds, and you are obviously those who are people of goodwill, with whom we who are followers of Jesus reach out openly. But you should know, while the Christian faith has sometimes been horribly distorted in the name of state policies or whatever, when you look at Jesus our Lord himself, you see something quite different. As John quoted, 800 years before his birth, the prediction by the great Hebrew prophet Isaiah was that he would come, and among many things he was called to be Prince of Peace. And when he was born, and the humble shepherds came down to see him in the manger, the angels announced peace on earth to people of goodwill. And anyone who reads the four Gospels that tell the story of Jesus, peace and peacemaking is at the heart of it. Blessed are the peacemakers, he said. And as he called people to his way of life, it was to love their neighbors as themselves. It was to forgive wrongs done to them without any limit. It was to return good for evil. And most difficult of all, it was to love enemies. But then, when he died, and his followers saw the significance of his death, they described it well as his making peace with God, so that we can have peace with God and then peace with our fellow human beings. Let there be no misunderstanding tonight. Whatever faith or background you come from, we who are followers of Jesus work with you for justice, for freedom, for peace. For those of you who ask the questions that I raised in the course of it, what is the basis for many of these things? I would urge you to look at, say, the Bible's view of human dignity in the light of people being made in the image of God. At a deeper level for yourself, I would say, as some of the earliest disciples said to some of those that they recruited, when they met Jesus of Nazareth, the Prince of Peace, they simply said, "Come and see. Come and see." We're an extraordinary moment in human history when men and women of goodwill must stand for things today, possibly at great cost, thanking God for great declarations like that which was signed 60 years ago, but knowing that there's much more to it than declarations. And what was begun then gives us a torch today that we must pass on to our children, burning more brightly than it is now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Guinness. Challenging, stimulating, inspiring, convicting. You can come up with about a dozen more descriptions of what we've heard tonight. We do live in an extraordinary time. What a great reminder. And with the anniversary around the corner, an excellent reminder of what remains yet to be done by men and women of goodwill. What a privilege to be part of the organization that you are a part of at this hour. Yes, there are a lot of difficulties, a lot of challenges, a lot of things that still leave many of us without sleep at night sometimes. But Dr. Guinness has pointed us to the person about whom we also sang tonight, the person of Jesus. And I would like, before we're dismissed tonight, I'd like you to give us a little feedback about what you heard tonight. At each of our tables, there's a small bag that has some cards in it. And there are two things that I'd like to ask you to do. I'd like you to give an honest response to what you've heard tonight from Dr. Guinness. But secondly, Dr. Guinness's latest book, Civility, in the Public Square, The Case for Civility.
an elaboration on some of the things tonight of which you've only heard in seed form will be available to you. We don't have nearly enough copies in hand right now to pass out tonight, but we will get you a copy if you would like to have a copy. And so on this card, I'd like you to indicate, please, I'd like a copy of Dr. Guinness's case for civility. While you're filling out those cards, I'd like to just say again, Dr. Guinness has pointed us tonight to the person, Jesus of Nazareth. Hundreds of years of Christmas carols bear testimony not only to the historicity of his life, but to the ever-present reality and power of his ability to transform human lives today.